Every Woman is a womanist show about women making a difference and the men by their side. As 50% of the world's population and 52% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The opinions and views expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the KKFI board, staff, volunteers, or sponsors of KKFI and the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated. I'm Annie Bell, and in the studio today is Sharon Lockhart, and we have our first guest is Lisa Waterman Gray, who is a travel writer and a food writer and in general, interesting traveled person. And in the second half of the hour, we are going to be talking with some ghost hunters. But first, we're going to go to the news.
And news to cheer about this week. Mayor de Blasio has begun a rent subsidy program that seeks to move 1,900 homeless families who are victims of domestic violence from shelters into permanent housing during the plan's first year. This was reported by the New York Times. Counseling efforts will also be increased within public housing, where domestic violence is especially high. Officials said they were also taking steps to relax admission requirements, such as expanding the range of crimes that constitute abuse, in order to place up to 100 abused families in public housing by the end of the year. More news to cheer this week. Barbara Streisand is lending her voice to a campaign to raise awareness to spark action against heart disease. More women than men have died of heart disease each year since 1984, and heart disease kills more women than all cancers combined. Streisand said this during an interview with USA Today. In an attempt to tackle the sexual harassment issue, many women are suffering on public transportation in France. The feminist group Dare Feminism launched a campaign to take back the metro. The group hopes its posters will expose the insecurity of women in public spaces and especially on public transport. Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus R. Vance Jr. has pledged $35 million in funding to help eliminate the backlog of untested evidence in sexual assault cases in cities across the United States. This was reported by Reuters. And around the country, what's happening to those kits? What we hear from the police and prosecutors is they want badly to test these kits, but they lack the funds. Vance said that at a news conference. McDonald's workers from New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles began traveling to 8 countries on 3 continents to enlist fast food workers, and this was reported by the Philippine Daily Inquirer. Women are a 2/3 of the people employed in low-wage jobs in industries such as fast food. You can follow the tour on Twitter via the hashtag #FastFoodGlobal. Forensic Nurse Week gave the International Association of Forensic Nurses a chance to raise awareness of their work as first responders to victims and perpetrators of violence who enter healthcare settings. These nurses provide care, collect evidence, and provide consultation in a variety of areas, including sexual assault, domestic violence, child abuse and neglect, along with death investigation, elder mistreatment, corrections, emergency services, mental health, and also public health. And in news to jeer this week, authorities in India have arrested the doctor that they say performed botched tubal ligations that sickened dozens and killed at least 13 women at an under-sanitary sterilization camp in rural India over the past weekend. At least 11 women have died and 62 were hospitalized after undergoing sterilization surgery at a government-run mobile health clinic in India. Locals say more than 80 women were operated on in just 6 hours by one doctor and his assistant. Such surgeries usually require 30 minutes for preparation and sterilization of equipment alone. Each woman was compensated 600 rupees, or about $10, and all women were poor. India carries out about 37% of the world's female sterilizations. Two Pakistani brothers were arrested for killing their mother and two teenage stepsisters after accusing them of adultery. Last year, 869 women died in honor killings, according to the Independent Human Rights Commission of Pakistan. The 2014 midterm elections will not be dubbed the Year of the Woman. The Brooklyn Institution reported this, and the summary likely finds that the next several election cycles will fall short as well. Authors Jennifer Lawless and Richard Fox describe the underlying gender gap as political ambition. And Jillian Fisher's mother has worked at Kmart for 21 years, but her mother still doesn't know if she's going to be told to work on Thanksgiving this year. Women in high-achieving fields are paid less than men, even in similar levels of experience. Now, women graduating business school reported expecting $14,548 less in annual pay than men in every field, and women were paid less than men based on a survey of graduating MBAs over 112 schools. Women who were entering finance reported the largest pay gap, with women earning close to $22,000 less than men.
All right, and we are here with Lisa Waterman Gray, and Lisa is a travel writer, and she, you know, has one of those enviable positions where she has to go write about interesting places, and in particular, interesting food.
Definitely.
Oh, how horrible that must be.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And you had, about 4 years ago, kind of a breakout travel book that was an explorer's guide to Kansas.
Right, right.
So how do you get your feet in the water with a job like that? How do you jump in and wind up with this excellent guide to travel in Kansas?
Well, I had been doing some travel writing for a relatively short time, but I had written about New Mexico several times. So I saw something that a woman wrote about New Mexico and noticed that editor was after her name. I contacted her and said, if you ever need anything about northern New Mexico, let me know, and can I check in with you occasionally? And we checked in a couple times, and then next thing I knew, one of us found the other on Facebook. I don't even remember who found who. Turned out she was an acquisitions editor for W.W. Norton out of New York City, and she asked me if I wanted to write a book about the state of Kansas on Facebook.
So you just made a connection.
I did.
With another woman.
Right.
And just reached out and said, hi, I also would like to do something like this. And
yeah, I actually wasn't talking to her about a book because I didn't really realize that that was what she did. I just knew she was an editor. And then I did have to write a full book proposal. I had to prove that I could handle the topic. But I didn't have to go looking for it, which was pretty remarkable.
That is an excellent story of just putting yourself out there,
right?
Making connections, women helping women, giving them a hand up into these kind of dream career opportunities. And that's the kind of stuff that we like to hear. That's the positive news that we like to see happening with women.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
Now, was there any one particular experience that really stood out when you were exploring Kansas?
Yeah, it actually was on my very first trip, and maybe some of it was because it was my first trip, but some of it was because I love the geology of western Kansas. And so there's a place called Monument Rocks where it looks like a natural Stonehenge, and the rock structures are probably the equivalent of at least 10 stories tall, and they're just out in the middle of nowhere. And it was absolutely lovely to see.
Well, I'm still a little bit confused by, I love the geology of western Kansas.
I think that's unexpected. I think Kansas suffers from a stereotype of being the single most boring place to drive through, and just drive through it as quickly as you can.
Well, that's if you're on the interstate. If you're on the interstate, you're going to miss things like this. You have to go on highways that take you away from the interstate. So if you're just taking I-70, you're not going to see some of these things. You have to go into the southwest corner of the state, not just across the state.
But you don't just write Kansas.
No, not at all. Not at all.
And recently, in fact, you were just in Branson, Missouri.
Right.
And, you know, I think a lot of people around here are fairly familiar with Branson, but is there anything that really drew you to that region this time of year?
Exactly that, this time of year. I wanted to see how Branson does the holidays, because there's so much written about Branson, and there's so many people who have been to Branson, but when you look at the overall number of people who've traveled there, not that many have been at the holidays. So that's what drew me down there.
And what kind of things did you see? I mean, what would you recommend?
We went to a diner. You know, here's Branson being an entertainment capital. We went to a diner called Mel's Hard Luck Diner. And the fellow who took it over, I believe it was in 2004, only hires wait staff that can sing. And I mean sing like the actual performer. I mean sing like some of his servers have gone on to American Idol. And they're singing at the same time that they are serving customers. And the food is good, too. But, I mean, the real attraction is that your servers are very talented people.
That sounds like that would be fun. I've never seen anything like that before.
Yeah, it was great.
I mean, everything in Branson is very much on the entertainment spectrum.
It definitely is. And we went to a ton of shows because, as a group of journalists, they wanted us to have the opportunity to get a broad range of experiences. So we saw all kinds of shows, and we went to Silver Dollar City and spent the better part of the day, well, probably half a day and evening at Silver Dollar City with all their holiday parade and food and special performances and that sort of thing. So it really was a cool experience.
And, you know, I'm kind of working you over. You've done the Kansas. You've gone as far as Branson. But you just recently came back from a trip to Torino.
Yes.
At the International Slow Food Conference.
Exactly, yeah.
There's no part of that doesn't sound wonderful. What is an International Slow Food Conference?
Okay. Slow food began several decades ago in Italy as a reaction to the first fast food restaurants coming into one of the major cities. I don't remember which one it was at this moment. And it was the whole idea that Italy has this rich tradition of artisan foods and handcrafted foods and small farmers. And this movement was a desire to reconnect with all of that. And the three watchwords are good, clean, and fair food. And what began in Italy has spread to include representatives in 175 countries, which, by the way, is only 15 fewer countries than are in the UN. And the conference, every 2 years, takes place in Italy because that's the birthplace of slow food. And it's an opportunity for people from all over the world to share their experiences, their questions, their concerns about good, clean, fair food. And so you bring together 3,000 delegates, and then you put them in a venue that includes information booths from many of those same people and an Italian marketplace, and you open it to the public, and you bring in more than 250,000 people in a 5-day period.
You know, I was looking at, you have a slideshow up on YouTube.
Yes.
You might want to go ahead and tell people where they might be able to find this on YouTube.
Yeah, if you just go to YouTube and then put in Lisa Waterman Gray, I have a channel that I believe has 25 or 26 slideshows now.
Well, the thing that got me about this slideshow at the Slow Food Conference was, like, it was almost like an Olympic parade of flags and things like that. And it just had this Olympic image, except the Olympics, and I love the Olympics, I love sports, I love the spirit of competition, but as far as bringing the world together, I think there's nothing that does that better than sitting down and sharing a meal.
Absolutely.
Which seemed to be what this was about. This would be what makes world peace, is you know, making wonderful food with all of these countries seems to be the answer to the problem of war in general.
Well, and when you're dealing with that many countries and that many potential languages, I mean, certainly English is a primary language, Italian is primary, French is primary, but there are a lot of other languages there too. And so you have to communicate somehow. And sometimes it's gestures, and sometimes it's three words in your language and 17 in theirs, you know, and it's just, it's the whole thing is a real immersion in world culture. It was amazing.
I'm just sitting here thinking that would be such an experience. Did you get to eat?
Yeah, during the conference, they had a canteen. So, and the canteen offered free lunches and dinners. So the food was good. Not quite like going out in the, city, but the food was good.
What is the definition of slow food? What does that mean?
Well, slow food just means trying to look for artisan food, trying to support local farmers, trying to sit down for a meal, taking your time with your food in every way, being aware of how it's sourced, how it's produced. So that's all part of what slow food is about.
So it is possible to go to Italy and do nothing but eat. Did you manage to do much of anything besides eat in Italy?
Well, certainly. Certainly. I mean, I only passed through Milan because of transportation. I had about 2.5 to 3 days in Ferrara. And Ferrara is my family's Italian Renaissance hometown. So I ate plenty of gelato and plenty of pizza and had some good wine. And, I got a fair amount of the authentic food that I could choose at will.
What part of Italy is Ferrara in?
Ferrara's in the Emilia-Romagna region, which is north and east in the country. And it's not terribly far from Venice. I met another woman in the hotel where I was staying who had come to the area on holiday, and she went to Venice for the day and then was able to come back to the hotel without it being, you know, too much of a hassle.
Now, Ferrara has a pretty interesting history, but it's not a place that people typically visit in Italy these days. Did it kind of, I mean, I know it was partially a visit to an ancestral home, but it kind of seems like that was a little bit of an off-the-map place for a travel writer.
Well, it was, but that can actually be an asset because, you know, let's go back to Branson. Branson is the place that a lot of people have written about, but not so many have written about the holidays. Venice is a place that a lot of people have written about. Rome is a place a lot of people have written about. Ferrara? Not as often. So part of the hope is this is off the beaten path. This is a subject that hasn't been done to death. And add on my family connection, and maybe that will be an angle that will have some special appeal.
Well, just to say this, when I saw that she had done some travel through Ferrara, I got so excited because Ferrara happens to be the hometown of a lot of just really cool women from the Renaissance.
Right.
And there is just this fantastic history out of Ferrara with really strong, powerful women who some of them were up to no good, others were up to less no good. I mean, it was just incredibly interesting stories. And I mean, there were men that did interesting things too
of
in
course.
Ferrara, but I just, some of my favorite Renaissance women called Ferrara home.
Yes, that's right.
And I am just happy to see it getting some attention because when you think Renaissance, you think Florence,
mm-hmm.
maybe Rome, you know, but mostly you're thinking of Florence and the Medici family and,
right.
and all of that. But Ferrara, they were supporting the arts and doing all kinds of spectacularly interesting things, and they've
Absolutely.
Just kind of fallen off the map in terms of visiting.
Well, and Ferrara, I mean, even aside from the historical buildings and the Renaissance history, it's a cool city. They have a culture of people being outside on the streets anytime, day or night, socializing. It's apparently the bike capital of Italy. I mean, I know many Italians ride bikes, but they're everywhere in Ferrara. And I just really felt like there was a constant party going on. A party of just, you know, having time together, enjoying each other, setting time aside to do that. And it was really, really nice.
Was there any type of local food that was kind of unique in Ferrara, or that kind of Eastern Italian cuisine? Or
well, my last meal that I ate there, I ordered I think the way you say it is Ferrarese pastry, and the pastry looks like a huge dough dumpling, but inside is meat and cheese and macaroni, and yet it's not overly heavy. The flour that is used there for everything has not been altered. There are no GMOs in Italy anywhere.
Oh,
and so
that sounds delicious.
Yeah, and so it had a completely different texture. It didn't make me feel bloated, and it was delicious on top of it.
My mouth is watering. I mean, I know you can't see my face right now, but if you could see me, you would see that I was drooling thinking about this delightful food. And, of course, you mentioned the gelato.
Yeah, I had some gelato about an hour and a half after I got to Ferrara, just because I had been on trains all day. I hadn't eaten much. And it was like, okay, I want something fast. And it was probably the best gelato I've ever had. And some of it may have just been, hey, I'm in Ferrara, I'm in Italy. But some of it, I'm sure, was just the quality of it and the attention to the ingredients, because it was so rich. And I'm a chocolate lover. Anybody who knows me knows that. And it was so chocolatey. And it was absolutely mind-blowing and taste-bud-blowing.
Yes, you're making it worse. I'm drooling all over the microphone. So I'm sure that almost everyone listening right now is thinking, when can I take a trip to Ferrara? And so if, you know, when they get over there, what is that really spectacular thing that you have to do this in Ferrara?
Well, you're going to see it as soon as you get to the center of town. You have to go to Castello Estance, which is the castle owned by the Este family, who were the rulers of the city. And they have, I'll call them minor, but they're not that small, several minor palaces around Ferrara as well. But this castle has four watchtowers, a moat, and it is enormous. The minute you get to the square, it's the first thing you see from any direction. So you have to do that. Beyond that, there are museums. There are other wonderful palaces, as I mentioned. And the Cattedrale di San Giorgio, which is not far from the castle. Absolutely gorgeous Renaissance cathedral where they do masses in the evening. And the first night I was there, they did a processional through the streets afterwards carrying candles. And it's kind of surreal and just really beautiful.
I am just picturing all of this in my head. What was the weather like?
I happened to hit Italy under wonderful weather conditions. For me, it got up into the 70s, but that's really not typical of mid to late October. Usually it's going to be, my understanding in that part of Italy, is at least 15 to 20 degrees cooler. So
it's kind of similar to our climate.
Yeah. Yeah, in northern Italy.
Well, I really appreciate you coming and talking to us about these travels.
My pleasure.
And do you have a website or some information where people could maybe find more or pick up a copy of your book, Explorer's Guide to Kansas?
The book is available through all of the typical book channels. It has been out a few years, so you might want to call ahead just to make sure that it's on a given shelf. And my website is lisawatermangray.com, and it has a link to my blog, which is kind of has fits and starts, but it's on right now. And my email's there and everything else.
Well, when the weather gets a little bit nicer, we might have to have you back on to help some people plan some day trips around Kansas. Or
oh,
maybe
sure.
Some weekend trips and that kind of thing, to get out, stretch their legs, shake off the winter. Look at me, I'm already thinking about shaking off the winter that's just now starting. But I would look forward to talking about that.
Sure, would love to.
Well, thank you very much. That's Lisa Waterman Gray. And we're going to take a quick break to listen to some PSAs is what they are. And we're going to come on with some Ghost Hunters.
Hey, do you want to get rid of your unused car, motorcycle, or boat and help KKFI at the same time? The proceeds from the sale of your vehicle will benefit KKFI, and the law allows a tax deduction equal to the gross proceeds from the sale of the donated vehicle. For more information, call the toll-free number at 1-866-628-2277.
Not a 90.1 FM presents Truck Stop Honeymoon, Cowgirls Train Set, and Carswell and Hope at the Lawrence Arts Center. That's November 22nd, 2014, from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. Tickets online at kkfi.org/events. November 22nd, Truck Stop Honeymoon, Cowgirls Train Set, and Carswell and Hope at the Lawrence Arts Center. Tickets at kkfi.org/events.
Support for 90.1 FM is provided by The Pitch. Do you need a gift for the foodie, socialite, and music lover on your gift list this holiday season? The Pitch Passport includes 5 parties for the price of 1 in 2015, including Sugar Rush, Vodka Vodka, Taste of KC, The Pitch Music Showcase, and The Pitch Music Awards. There are only 100 passports available, and when they're gone, they're gone. For more information, visit pitch.com or call 816-561-6061.
Project Censored's Mickey Huff speaks about their latest list of underreported news stories, particularly the environmental stories, on the next Eco Radio KC, Monday at 6 p.m.
And welcome back to Every Woman. My name is Beth Pike, and joining me in the studio today is the 10th Dimension Paranormal Group, who operates out of Kansas and Missouri. And we've got quite a room full, so I'm just going to try to announce everyone and say hello. Hector is in the room with us. Hector.
Hi, Dan.
Diana.
Hello.
Viv.
Hi.
Hi. Gary.
Hello.
Pam.
Hello.
And Kelly.
Hi.
And then we wanted to make note, too, Sharon, that it was your daughter who brought the group to us.
Yes, because she and Diana, ride Harleys together.
Oh, awesome. I'm a Harley rider as well. Well, first off, let's get a little history on the group. How did it all get started?
Actually, it started about, I want to say 2000, November 29th, 2000. We started having encounters and stuff, and Pam and I were actually the co-founders. And we decided after a few incidents and a few cases that we wanted to form the group. And we got together with some doctors and nurses, and we formed the 10th Dimension Paranormal Group, and we've been going ever since.
All right. What would you say, then, is maybe the top three, four encounters that you've had?
I'm going to let Diane start with her encounter.
Okay, Diane.
He would make me go first. My favorite encounter so far is based out of Kingsville, Missouri. It was a shapeshifter that we came in contact with, and he was not the friendliest little character. He was probably 3-4 foot tall. He had a goatee, pointed chin. He had ears that you could see because we caught him on camera a few times. He was playing havoc in the house, doing things that is not normal. To get rid of that little character was... we had to involve Indian tribes. In our group, we have several tribes, and we had to contact our elders and do some studying to figure out how to get rid of this little guy. And we managed it, you know, and it was very pleasing to know that we helped these people.
I just wanted to ask what a shapeshifter is. That's something I've never heard
okay.
of before.
I'll describe that for you. A shapeshifter, you hear the werewolf, where a man turns into a werewolf. Well, a shapeshifter is an Indian spirit that over time, 200-300 years, decides that he can manipulate what he's around. If there's a goat farm, he can be a goat. If there's a horse farm, he can be a horse. Whatever the case may be. In this particular incident, this was in Kingsville. This was an actual goat farm. And he imitated ghosts. They go out there and they count the goats. They have 12 one day, 13 the next. They couldn't figure it out. Then when we captured this goat figure, he had hoofs, and he had human legs, he had human hands, but he had horns, and he had a goat face, but he's only like 2.5-3 feet tall, like Diana said. And he was incredibly mean. I mean, he was physically hurting these people, physically. And that's why Diane and all of us talk about a shapeshifter is something that you very seldom run into, but we had the unfortunate opportunity to run into this one.
But the Native Americans have believed in shapeshifting.
Right, or skinwalkers, as they refer them to also. Yeah.
For quite some time. Yeah. And when you said he was doing mean things, antics, any description on what exactly those were?
Well, he... he was messing with the animals in the house. He would literally sit. They had a huge bird cage, and he would literally sit in the bird cage and pluck feathers off these birds. You can just hear them squawk. He was, at that time, the girl that lived in the house, she was 17?
16.
16, 17, and he was physically doing things to her. I think how that started was she would go to cemeteries and think, oh, those are cool headstones, and she would do etchings on the headstones, you know, with paper and a pencil and do etchings. Well, she seen some headstones back further and was etching them, and they had symbols on them. That's Indian. That's sacred. You don't want to go in there, you know, and so that's what she was doing, was getting the etchings off of that, and that's where that started. That's how the whole episode started.
Okay. All right, is that the only thing that you have to add to that story, or would you like to...
No, that's...
Okay.
That went well enough, so no more.
Okay, Diana. Did we have... was it Pam or Gary?
Viv and Gary had one.
Okay, Viv and Gary had one of the stories.
Okay, well, let me just give you a lead into their incident.
Okay.
This was at Sugar Creek Gym here in Independence, right outside of there.
I'm familiar.
We got invited to go out there, and Diane called me a couple of days before and said that she had a vision of a little kid. She said maybe 8, 9 years old. Well, we went into the gym that Saturday night, and right. Pam walked in, and Pam says, there's a kid up in the corner, and he's got polio, and he's about 9 years old. He's got knee braces, and that's as far as you could get and watch everybody else play sports. Well, I was walking down the gym, and I didn't hear this part of the conversation. That was between Dwayne and Pam. And I was walking up, and I said, hey, we had a young kid here that was playing in the spring during flooding on a tree, and he was, you know, the ropes that just swing across the creek.
Right.
He slipped, the rope broke, and he fell, hit his head in the creek and drowned. This was 1913. And, you know, what's unusual was that there was no way to confirm it at that time. Well, we set up a booth, John Wayne Days, whatever, Sugar Creek Landing, whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they're called, but I was at a booth, and the next thing I know, here comes two golf carts with police officers, and they had a gentleman with him. The gentleman says, he's like 80-some, 89, around there, and he says, you're Hector? And I go, yes. And he goes, I understand you've been telling people that you found a kid by the name of Matt, 13 years old, that drowned in the creek here at Sugar Creek in 1913. I said, yes, that's me. I'm sorry if I'm wrong. He said, no, that was my grandfather's son. He said, it actually happened exactly as you said. He said, it was not in newspapers. It was not documented because of the people that were involved back then. It was Richie that kept it hush-hush because of the people.
Right.
He said, but it did actually happen. He says, I'm just here to confirm and let you know that. He says, I'm just in awe and fascinated by what you said. He said, nobody's mentioned that in all those years.
So there was no documentation in newspapers. There
right,
was nothing in the past, but yet you yeah. were able to come up with the story of right. the boy.
And then this gentleman by the name of Charles, I never met before, pulls up with police escort, and he says, I need to talk to you and verify what he had been told. He verified it to the team. So we started investigating the Sugar Creek Gym. And that's when Viv and Gary.
Come on, step on in, Viv. Okay. So we're going to have now Viv and Gary with the 10th Dimension Paranormal Group talk to us a little bit more about the Sugar Creek incident. So please.
Hi, I'm Viv. And this is Gary. We have been members for about a year and a half, and we've been trying to do a particular experiment called a flashlight experiment. Anyone who's watched any paranormal television shows has probably seen that. You take a flashlight and you twist it so that it barely turns off, and you set it somewhere and you try to get an entity to interact with you by turning the flashlight on. So we had tried this at a number of locations, and it wasn't until the Sugar Creek Gym when we actually got it to work, and I was really surprised. I think it was Diana that was talking, and for some reason, this little boy or Matthew or whoever we were talking to would specifically normally answer to her. And she would ask him to turn it on the count of three, and he would turn it on. And then on the count of three, he would turn it off. And I was quite surprised. I thought, okay, something has to be going on. This is not right. So I sat there for about an hour and a half monitoring this flashlight just to make sure that it wasn't going on like every 2 minutes and 30 seconds and staying on for 20 seconds. It didn't work like
was
that.
Wasn't timed or anything.
No, it wasn't
like
timed. And it was pretty much going on by her questioning. Very interesting. Then we went to the Sugar Creek. There was a park out by Sugar Creek we went to after that. And we were dealing with, I believe, the same spirit out there because we had the same flashlight experience there. And really, that's about the only place we've been to that has done flashlight on demand. We were at one another place recently that was close. But it was very interesting how it turned out and just answering questions for us.
I just had just one of these really weird thoughts of, does your entity have to be young enough to know what a flashlight is for this to work, or is this...
You know, that's a good question. The place that we just left not too long ago was an older house. We figured, I think, Hector, there were some probably Indians there. We called it a torch. They didn't know what a flashlight was, and they turned on for us last week at the house we were at. We called it a torch. And because they don't know what they're looking at.
Yeah,
right.
that was the first thing that crossed my mind, is some of these entities might be older than flashlights.
Yeah, they have no idea.
A lot of these entities, what they do is they don't understand.
Yeah, I need to come just a little bit closer, Hector, please.
A lot of these entities, when you know, they've been dead for 200 or 300 years, or even 50 years, or let's take an example, an Indian, 150 years ago. They don't know what a TV is, what a light switch is, what turn on a faucet is. What they do is they sit in the corner and they watch you. And you go do it and they mock you. And so people have things happening in their house. They're buried, their house on Indian grounds, and the Indians couldn't contact them because they used to knock and doing the Indian traditional things. But now they can go up and they can do a light switch, turn your lights on and off because they learned that from you. They turn on water faucets because they saw you do it. They mock you. That's how they're communicating. And people get scared to death because of that. At Sugar Creek, we have things that are incredible happen. I mean, Kelly was with me down in the basement. We had a group down there, a fundraiser. And Kelly, come on, tell them what happened to you.
Come on up here, Kelly.
it was just pretty simple in the fact that the flashlights just kept going on and off, and there was nothing there that I could figure out that was making it happen, and it was answering our questions and responding to us. And I kept thinking, there's something that's got to be making this go on, but everything I looked at, it was in the middle of the table. There was nothing that was even electric around it.
And when you say answering your questions, so elaborate on that.
We have a piece of equipment. It's called a tuner, and it has red light, green light, and we ask red for yes, green for no. We also have flashlights, and we have other means of communicating. And when we were doing this, we were asking this entities to turn on anything and everything. We had, what, three flashlights?
We had three flashlights.
And we want one for yes, one for no, one for just to play with. And we would ask them, one was red, blue, and black is what it was. Mm-hmm. We asked them by colors to turn on flashlights. And they would turn on that particular flashlight. One kid asked a question, and he said, turn all three on at once. Boom, all three came on. He said, oh, wow, turn them off. Boom, all three went off. So they will communicate with you, and they're very good about it. I mean, I've been doing this since 1972 as a group member, long group, and I've never had a mean experience where they physically try to hurt you, throw you up against the wall like you see on TV.
Was that at the Sugar Creek?
Yes, Sugar Creek Gym.
My daughter joined you there, and she shared with me, she saw this stuff happening, and she was in awe because she didn't know whether you guys were manipulating that or not. She was just blown away by it. And I also want us not to forget to talk about orbs, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And one thing we did bring up to the group there at Sugar Creek, and I make always a point to bring this up, is we take our K2 meters, we take all our equipment, we bang on the table, we move it around, we let people touch it, control it. We want to make sure that nothing is interfering, nothing is done by us, remote control, nothing. What you get is what we get. What you see is what we see. So when all this is going on, it's the spirits. And I actually have our equipment set up that if we don't get no communication, it will shut off. So there's nothing. So whatever happened between that time and the time it shut off was not us, it was the entities communicating with us.
Okay. So that was two. I thought there were three different, wasn't there one?
The one was North Carolina.
North Carolina. Yes, we were talking about this before out in the green room. North Carolina. Now,
one of our daughters lived in North Carolina with her children, and that was our main focus on how we started this group because we needed to get more people involved to help us. They were bothering the children. There are residual hauntings. A lot of people are, this is an entity that doesn't realize he's dead, and they repeat the last thing they do. And one of my grandsons was like 2 and a half, and he's like, Mommy, why does that man keep walking out my window? And we didn't understand what he meant. And then he kept saying, well, this man, he's in blue, and he keeps walking through my room and going out my window. And we were trying to figure it out, and they lived in Fayetteville, so there was a lot of turmoil from the war and everything. And we showed him uniforms, and he actually picked out a captain's Confederate uniform and said this is what he was wearing. It wasn't a picture of that man. He said he didn't have a hat, but he had his sword, and he was walking, but he walked through my window every night. Alarms were going off. They actually had an alarm company come out, and the poor guy would screw in the wires and go to check something, come back, and the wires would be unscrewed. And you know it's not the children when you have a 6-month-old, a 2-and-a-half-year-old. He's like, I got to call my boss. He said, do you realize your house is haunted? Okay. Yes, we do. let me talk to him. So my daughter would talk to him, and they were able to get the alarm system finally hooked up. They had one incident where they woke up, and there was black soot in their house as if there had been a fire. My son-in-law panicked, called 911, had the fire department come. There was no fire. Where the black soot from? They don't know. They could never figure it out. And so we did a 7-day cleanse. We did several things to clean it up and make it restful for the family. But subsequently, being in the military, they moved. So they're not there at the house anymore. But our grandson, he's older now, and he believes in this stuff, and he's with us, and he enjoys doing it with us, too.
Okay.
He has an open mind, and that's the one thing you have to remember to do when you do this type of work, or you go into a home trying to help people, and you have to keep an open mind and listen to their side of the story and try to figure out what has happened or what's going on.
All right. Now, Sharon had wanted someone to speak on orbs.
Yes.
Well, but there was one other thing I just thought of, was about when you go into these homes, you are careful not to provoke the spirit. Someone, right. That might be a good time to talk about that.
Right. Why do you not provoke? Right.
We're firm believers that you can get more with a piece of candy than you can with a rock. Mm-hmm. We don't believe that you need to provoke or instigate any kind of activity. When we go in with a positive, good attitude, and we get positive back. You go in with negative, you're going to get negative. And you have to remember that when you provoke, whether the place is occupied or not, you leave those entities, those spirits have been disturbed to the max. They're going to be pissed off. Whoever comes in there is going to get the grief of anger that they have gotten from us or whoever provokes. So for that reason, and we leave that people's house. You don't want to leave anybody's house after you provoke. They're going to get the brunt of the kickback from the spirits. So you don't do that. There's no reason to do it.
Right, it's like going in and kicking their cat.
Right, yeah. There's no reason. You go in there, you're there to communicate with the spirits. And one thing I always do, and Pam, Diane will verify, is whenever we go to a new location, I'll go in first. But what I do is I go in and introduce ourselves and our group, and I tell them, hey, I'm here to take pictures. I'm here to communicate with you. We're here to show you the utmost respect. We're your guests. And that's all we are, as your guests. We'll leave here, and when we do, we want you to stay here. Don't follow any of us home. And we'll show you the same respect you show us, and we're going to take pictures, we're going to take videos, and we want to communicate with you. That's it. And we get incredible, incredible activity.
And you know, one of the questions was demons or bad ghosts. What about angels and good souls?
You know what? Okay, I can describe, but it's going to take. Let's start off with the demons, okay? The demonic. We get a lot of calls from people that say we have demons in our house, okay? Or that there's malevolent entities in our house that are just destroying things, turning furniture upside down, whatever. We'll go in and my first impression is, well, if you have a demon of that magnitude, you wouldn't be calling me. I mean, you'd be out of there. And a lot of people do call me from other houses saying that it's that bad. Matter of fact, I'm doing 2 or 3 cases right now where they're calling us from other houses. We get to the house, and it's for some reason we don't get that activity that they're giving us. Sometimes they embellish what the activity is, or they don't understand it. The spirits trying to communicate. They have spirits that are trying to communicate with them. And a lot of times it turns out to be the ancestors trying to tell them something. And
that was a question I had earlier. Was it that the spirit was someone that was maybe in that property prior, or is that spirit connected to the person who is in the property? Is it past family members, relatives, or is it someone that may have passed on in the residence?
All of the above.
Yes, everything.
All of the above.
We got 2 cases right now. We got one in Kansas that we're doing. It's a relative. They've been there. They built the house. They've been there for generations. The one we're getting ready to do today, they're just starting to remodel it. They're moving into it. So that gives you the 2 extremes, one with ancestors, one towards the grounds. And they are the house, and today is on Indian Railroad grounds. So.
And what normally brings these people to contact you? I mean, what has happened within the home? You know, I've heard of cold spots. Things like that. I've heard of doors being slammed. You know, what maybe gets the family member or the person in the residence to contact you because they feel that they have an entity or a spirit?
Fear.
Fear.
They have a lot of fear.
Yeah, the fear of the unknown. But 50 years ago, 60 years ago, if you said you heard a ghost, you went to the funny farm. Nobody believed you because it was a faux-pas. You did not talk about that. Now it's out in the open. Right. So people are able to talk about it. That's why we're getting so many more phone calls now from people, because there's no reason to be embarrassed. You heard something, you saw something, and you want to know what it is, and there's no reason to be afraid of it. So that's why we do this. We're trying to help you, because a lot of times, like we say, it's a family member and they just want to be heard. Grandma's mad because you're letting the cat on the couch. We had that in Kingsville. They had a settee that belonged to Grandma, and the cats were destroying it, and Grandma was a little mad about it. Once we got it cleaned up and covered up, Grandma was happy.
And the house was peaceful.
The house was...
So, what other things do you do to maybe cleanse an area or a home or a location? How about that? Cleansing.
We do a lot of sage cleansing. There's a saying that we give the residents of the home to go around their house, but they have to say it with meaning and be strong about it, you know, because they have to start at a certain area and end in a certain area, and they have to go a certain direction. So saging helps a lot. They have to sage closets, windows, everywhere. If you can get up into the attic, we will get up there to do the cleansing as well.
Okay, and that's the smudge stick, like the sage?
That's the lowest form of cleansing.
Mm-hmm.
Second thought, you can just actually talk to them, set guidelines. Pam's good at telling people, I said guidelines, just talk to the entities and see if that'll work. Let the worker go to the saging. Then we go to the saging part two, which is basically where we use different type of herbs. We might add sweet grass. We might add different types of sages or just herbs and make it stronger. Then we go into the seven-day candle ceremony. Then we go on from there. We've had Wiccan ceremonies. We try to cover it all. The only thing we don't do is an exorcism, but we have people in our Florida branch that are related that go to the Vatican about once, twice a year. And we have demonologists down there, and they can do an exorcism. So we turn it over to them. When it comes to something like that, we'll back off. I mean, we'll do it as far as we go, maybe a deliverance. That's the extent of it.
Okay. So you feel like something like that needs to be given over
to
someone
else. And then it takes the church about 2 or 3 years to do that. So.
And then what about the helping, helping people and souls?
Crossing over souls.
Crossing over, okay.
We try to. A lot of times they just have, like what we did last weekend. We did an EVP session. Is there a message you want to give to somebody? They just want to say something. And one of our EVPs, you could hear plain as day, was a woman said, sorry. And that's all she needed to say, was she needed to apologize for something, and then she can move on. And a lot of times that just comes to acknowledgement, I'm here, I want to say goodbye, or anything like that. But we really do try to specify to the entity, if you're ready, you can move on. And there are different ways. You know, we can tell them where the local church is, and you can go there, down there and be in a peaceful, calm place and move on from there. There are several different things and several different ways of doing it. But you just have to be open and honest. And honesty is the best thing, even if you are talking to a spirit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They're no different than...
No, there's no difference. And a lot of times, like I said, they just want to be heard.
And here, I noticed, it says, a spirit once told this to me in the middle of a dream. Who wants to do the quote? Hector.
That's mine. Let me explain. Maybe I need to go back a little bit first before you...
You only have a couple of minutes.
Only a couple minutes?
Okay.
All right. 2000... November 29th on her birthday, I died. I died for 12 minutes. I crossed over. So I spent 12 minutes in an incredible place. I mean, it was, I don't have enough time to explain it now, but I came back and everything was good. And Pam and I, we talked and we knew what we had to do. About 2 years later, I was in bed, 3 in the morning, dark, and I always keep a pen, notepad by the bed. And all of a sudden, in the middle of my dream, this bright light came through, and this figure came down. And he was there, I don't know how long, but he said something. And I'm like, and then everything disappeared. So I wrote it down, darkness. Next morning, I got up, and I said, oh, yeah, I had a visit. Let me see what. So I wrote, and I looked at it, and I'm like, Pam, look at this. This is not me. I'm not smart enough to come up with something like this. This is not me. And what it said was, meanness is a means to an end. Kindness is the road to eternity. And I had three ministers from different churches look this up for me for 6 months. I said, just show me anything, anywhere, where this was written before. And one by one, they came back after 4, 5, 6 months, and they all said, we can't find this. What happened? Where'd you get this? And I explained to them. And they're just freaking out. They're like, you had a visit from an angel. You had an angelic visit. You're so blessed, so lucky. And I said, well, I'm glad you're telling me that, because I know I'm not smart enough to come up with that. So,
it wasn't mine.
I don't take
it. But it really is touching. Meanness is a means to an end. Kindness is the road to eternity. It's very moving. So, Sharon, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That is pretty impressive, I'm telling you.
I'm
touching him on the shoulder here. That is pretty special. And you know, talking about back to the wanting to leave, I'm not sure I want to leave, but here's the deal. I mean, don't kick me out of here too early. I want to hang around and watch what's going on. Back to those orbs.
Yeah.
What about
the orbs? Let me get to the orbs.
I have pictures of orbs.
Let me get to the orbs.
People tell me I'm crazy.
No. Okay, orbs. I did a 3.5-year study of orbs. We got incredible pictures of orbs. Orbs, to me, are soldiers of the spirit world. They are deterrents. They show up, and they will do their best to try to get your attention so that you can focus on them while there's something big, major happening somewhere else in that same area. You know how many times we've taken pictures of orbs, and we turn around, and there'll be a full-fledged entity over here walking? We've had three Indians walking across, but the orbs are doing everything possible over here to keep us attention. Orbs also have faces and different, they're animals. And I call them energy because it could be an animal, it could be a human, it could be whatever living energy puts out there. But a lot of people think because they're black orbs that they're negative. That's not true. The darker the orb, the more energy it has. It can do more. And that's not to say it would be negative, mean. It can just, you have a black orb, it can maybe open and close a door or turn on a light, or a white orb cannot do that. So I hope that answers your orb a little better. But orbs
more
exist.
Questions, yeah. I think I want to join your group.
But yeah, orbs are definitely the first thing we look for, and it's pretty common. It's like a lot of people don't believe in orbs because of what they are. To me, that's like going into a hospital and not believing that the babies not born yet aren't humans. You know, they're there. They're there.
And as interesting as all of this has been, I'm so sorry to say that we are out of time.
Yeah. Well, it has been a pleasure.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Diana, Bev, Hector, Viv, Gary, Pam, Kelly, with the 10th Dimension Paranormal Group of Kansas and Missouri.
And make sure you stay tuned for Urban Connections with Donna Wolf coming up next.